Told you last week I didn't know whether we were going to deal with all of the details in Romans 9 about the things that the Israelites were characterized in regard to or in connection with. But we are going to take the covenants this evening and verse 4 as a topic of our study because they're significant and because I have been in a love affair with the covenants for years and years and years now. In a way, I suppose, what I'm going to say this evening isn't going to be news to any of you. But it is, in a very real sense, at the very heart, I believe, of God's plan of life. And it may well be for that reason that Paul was so upset about his brethren being so stiff-necked and hard-hearted that it caused him to have great sorrow and unceasing grief in his heart. So unnecessary for people to have to go through all that we go through simply because we don't like what God has said about it, or we don't even know what he said about it. In Israel's case, that's not really the case. They knew. Israel was heavily involved in the knowledge of the scriptures, kind of like, well, I suppose when the people that came over here to settle this country from the persecution in Europe, they set up a sort of a theocracy in each community here where the preacher was the mayor of the city or whatever. And the Bible was their basic educational book. And as a consequence, even in the days of some of the revivals, unbelievers knew all this stuff. I mean, when you go into a religious debate, everybody knew what everybody was talking about, and they had their pros and cons and all that, because it was ingrained in the culture to be aware, biblically. And, of course, we've drifted so far from that now that there are gobs of people in this country that have absolutely no biblical knowledge at all, anywhere, because they've been barred from it by the educational choices and stuff that they've been subjected to. I think that that's part of the reason for my interest in the covenants, but as we go through it this evening, you'll see again. The issue of the covenants is the issue of God actually engaging men so that they could enjoy the life that he has to offer to them. That's the issue of the covenants. The covenants are just codified promises. They are commitments that God has made. He actually engaged these human beings with covenant commitments where, like Hebrews says, whenever God says something, that makes it true. But sometimes, because he's very interested in people believing him, he will interpose with an oath. And God doesn't have to swear that he's going to do something. If he says he's going to do it, he's going to do it. But men don't believe that. So sometimes God acquiesces or at least aligns himself with their great weakness and does something to kind of bolster that. And I think that's what a covenant is. It's kind of God coming in alongside of a great weakness on our part and committing himself formally by covenant to some things that are necessary for our exposure or our understanding of life. In the last study, we looked at the issue of the glory. And we determined, at least I did, I don't know what y'all decided about it, but at least I determined that at its essence, the glory consists of the character and attributes of God in terms of which of those attributes and to what degree are they to be shared by human beings in the future. We talked about those attributes that don't have an inherent moral issue involved with them, and then we talked about some that did have. And the glory of God that we're going to participate with are those attributes that have to do with the moral issues of how we treat one another, how persons in a multi-person universe, a kingdom of many, many, many people, we all have to have the same basic core attitude in order to treat one another properly. And that's why, as we are going to see a little bit later in our study today, that the final covenant was a commitment on God's part to write on the heart his law so that it would automatically be the case that we would follow it. But we'll get into that a little bit later. The issue of the hope is established in Romans 5:2 as our hope. We I've been justified by grace through faith, and by grace we stand in that by faith, and we hope for the glory of God. Well, that's not just an empty phrase. It's a hope that we're going to be conformed to the image of that glory, so that one of the immediate impacts of it will be that we will not any longer be groaning over our own failure to live up to what we know we ought to. Paul admitted in Romans chapter 8 that even though we have the Spirit of God dwelling in our bodies, and He's perfectly capable of producing His fruit through us, His capacity and our willingness to go along with it are two different things. And as a consequence, we as believers often find ourselves groaning over decisions we've made and actions we've taken that we shouldn't have made or taken. And he says we're longing for the adoption, which is the redemption of the body, where the individual, by virtue of the redemption of the body, is finally now a complete whole human again and has the glory, the moral character that is required for a kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy that endures forever. So, Paul goes as far to say that this is what we're looking forward to, because in this world you can only hunger and thirst for righteousness. You're not going to ever be satisfied with the way things are in this world until Jesus is the master of the world as he sits on the throne of David. So we're looking forward to active participation in being totally involved in loving and being loved with the love of God, and including everybody that's in his kingdom. This evening we're going to look into the next issue that's listed, and that's the covenants. And Paul's fixation on the covenants, again, is addressed as something that should be the Israelites' experience, but is not because of their apostate condition. They refuse the gospel. They've refused their God. They had him crucified, and they've rejected him out of hand. And all of their religious practice and all that is really not the worship of the one true God. In fact, they stoned Stephen because he accused them of worshiping idols in the wilderness in the name of God. But nonetheless, Paul wants us to understand his commitment to Israel, because Israel had been given by God a declaration of a plan by God to engage human beings by making certain covenant commitments to certain Israelites as extensions of his covenant that he made with Abraham. So let's just ask and answer the question, what are the pertinent covenants? The term covenants and the number of covenants in the Bible are multiple. The references to covenants are multiple. But the only ones we have to be concerned about in this text are the ones that are identified specifically with the Israelites. What I mean by that is the covenants that Paul's talking about in verse 4 are to be distinguished from any and every other covenant that's addressed to humanity in general. And the main one that comes to mind is the Noahic covenant, where God promised Noah and humanity in general that he would never flood the earth with water again. He gave a bow in the clouds as a commitment, a sign of this covenant. At that time, he didn't say he wouldn't burn it up, but he did say he wouldn't flood it up again. So there was always this understanding, even the ancients, that God destroyed the world with water in the flood, but he's going to approach it with fire the next go-around, because it's going to be a far greater issue second time around. But that covenant's not in view here. The covenants that Paul's talking about are the ones that have to do with Israel. And they are declarations by God of commitments that he's willing to make. And there are a couple of things about those commitments that we need to be aware of. There is a covenant called the covenant at Mount Horeb, which is the covenant of the law, which was a conditional covenant, and it was a temporary covenant. Israel didn't know it was temporary, but they did know it was conditional, because basically it was a covenant between God and the Israelites where he would be their king and they would be his people, and it would be his theocratic kingdom and they would be his subjects. And so he had certain things that he required of them and certain commitments that he made to them. But Paul's argument in the New Testament was that that covenant was interposed 430 years after the promise was given to Abraham for a reason, and it was a temporary reason, and the reason was that God had an intention to compel people to come back to promise and faith rather than rely on performance and law, because relying on performance and law is death. The law will kill you. Nobody can live under the law. The law says do this and live, and don't do this and live, and do this and die, and don't do this and die. I mean, the law had all these requirements, and death and life were the issues out of it. And human beings under sin are going to do what they're told not to do, and they're not going to do what they are told to do. So they're all going to die. And that's why it was a temporary covenant. It was interposed for a reason, but the reason wasn't to govern the life of the people, and it wasn't understood to be a commitment by God for the life of the people. So that brings us back to the original covenant, and that's Genesis 12, 1-3. The covenant God made with Abraham. When I was first introduced to the Abrahamic covenant, way back, years and years and years ago, probably shortly after I got saved, the issue was always presented as land, seed, and a blessing. Land, seed, and a blessing. That's the Abrahamic covenant, land, seed, and a blessing. In fact, there was a fellow that did home Bible studies that popularized the idea of walking through the scriptures on the basis of the covenants, and his thing was land, seed, and a blessing. Well, I believe that's a misrepresentation of the covenant, and it's a mistake, big time, in some regards. It's been called land, seed, and blessing because of the misreading of the text. The promises really were land, seed, and a great name. And because of these things, you will be a blessing. It doesn't say, and because of these, you'll be a blessing. But he does say he's going to give him a land and a seed and a great name, and you will be a blessing. Well, if you're the first believer in the roots of life, which have to do with God's commitments to provide everything that you need for life, and you believe that and live like that, then you will be a blessing to everyone you're around. So we shouldn't take it as land, seed, and a blessing. It should be land, seed, and a great name. I really don't know why the focus went to blessing rather than the great name. Almost everybody just ignores the fact that he promised him a great name in terms of their treatment of the Abrahamic covenant. Well, I shouldn't say everyone. I haven't read everyone. But it's misreading the text to call it that. It's land, seed, and a great name were the commitments. And I believe that it sprang out of a larger ignorance as to the impact that God intended for this covenant to make on Abraham. Why did God promise him land, seed, and great name? What did God intend for Abraham to gain by believing in the promise of land, seed, and great name? And for me, my understanding of the whole issue is that the larger context, the first 11 chapters of Genesis cover 2,000 years of human history. And then all of a sudden in chapter 12, you come to this screeching, and it covers, I don't know how many chapters there are in the rest of Abraham's life, but it only covers about 100 years. You cover 2,000 years, and all of a sudden, and then all of a sudden you're into all these details that have to do with 100 years of his life, from the time he's 75 till he dies as 175. So you got to assume that the first 11 chapters are part of the larger context of chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. And in my thinking, Genesis 3 is the larger context with covenant commitments made by God. Because it was in Genesis 3 that man forsook his confidence in God as the author of life. It was in Genesis 3 that the serpent came in and seduced Eve and then Adam into thinking that God would not supply them with life. That life was up to them. That God was some kind of a heavy-handed manipulator, and they needed to be a little bit independent from him in order to be able to make sure they could live well the way they wanted to. And it was all a lie. It was a huge deception. And for the life of me, I can't figure out how Adam and Eve got sucked into that, except that they had no idea that they were being suckered. And as long as you're not aware, you're a pretty easy target. But Genesis 3 highlighted three problems of humanity brought on by the effect of temptation. the temptation had to do with Adam and Eve and their physical condition. It had to do with Adam and Eve and their soulish condition. And it had to do with Adam and Eve and their spirit condition. Because those are the three categories, body, soul, and spirit. And not only that, but 1 John 2, John, the gospel writer, summarized everything about this world by saying, all that's in the world is the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. Well, those are exactly in harmony with Genesis 3's temptation issues. And then when you compare that to the two gospel accounts that record the temptation of Christ in any detail, he is tempted along the lines of the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, exactly like Adam and Eve were in the garden in terms of the categories. So when you put all that together, what you find is that Satan introduced sin as a dominant issue according to all of man's glory. His glory being his makeup as physical, soulish, and spirit. So he hit him at all three levels and succeeded at all three levels, and man became a slave to sin at all three levels. And John says the real problem here is that the body has certain lusts, and the soul has certain lusts, and the spirit has certain lusts called the pride of life, or the arrogance of boastfulness, or the arrogance of functional capacity. But those are the only three things there are in the whole world. So you get those categories down, and all of a sudden things start to make sense. And that means that Genesis 1 to 12 were clear corollaries to the problems that sin introduced. Eve ate the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil because it was good for food. Well, what did she need food for? Well, her body. And so the physical appetites of the body and the need for food became a major issue for humanity. And the appetites of the flesh exploded from there. Not only food, but rest and sleep and covering and all these other things that come right out of our physical makeup. Those things exploded in terms of the details, but the essence is the desire of the body, the flesh. And so God told Abraham that he was to leave the source of his physical sustenance, the land, and God would give him a land. So that's the land promise. If you trust God, Abraham, you'll never lack for food and whatever you need from the ground to make you physically capable of living. And then he was to leave his kinsmen, which was his area of security, because the bigger your tribe, the safer you were in a tribal kind of setting like that. So whenever you went anywhere, it was all for one and one for all. And people made their decisions about how aggressive they would be toward you according to how many other people would be immediately involved if they were aggressive toward you. And so to leave that was to leave your security in the relational world. And he said, I will give you a seed and make a great nation out of that seed. So your relational security issues will be met by my provision of a seed who would meet those. And then the issue of the great name was the issue of you shall be as Elohim. That was the promise. That was this huge status thing for Eve and Adam. And God addressed that by saying your spirit has a longing to be significant. And I'm going to make a commitment to you to give you that status. I'm going to give you a great name. And you will have a great name. Now, as it works out in history, a great name among men doesn't mean a whole lot. But Abraham's called the father of those who believe. So even among believers, he has a great reputation. And that was a significant thing. So as far as I'm concerned, the Abrahamic covenant was designed to address the problems of Genesis 3. And Abraham, by believing those three things, could live a life that was not dominated by sin's impulses and sin's demandingness, if he believed them. But he failed on multiple levels in his life growth. But he grew. And out of his failures and growth, he became the friend of God. and the father of all who believe. And he lived to be a ripe old age of 175 and died with a smile on his face because his life had been good. That was the reason for the covenant. In fact, that covenant was described by Paul in Romans chapter 4, verse 13, as the foundation for Abraham's inheritance of the world. Abraham was going to be the heir of the world on the basis of the Abrahamic covenant, Genesis 12. It was associated with life in this manner. In 1 John 2:25, John says, this is the promise that he promised us, eternal life. And then in Ephesians 2, verse 12, Paul talks about the Gentiles who are in horrible condition because they're separate from the covenants of the promise. Which means that the covenants are designed to fulfill the promise. And the promise is life. So the Abrahamic covenant was designed to give Abraham the capacity to live. If he believed them. If he believed them, he wouldn't go down to Egypt because there was a famine in the land of Israel. God would supply his herds and flocks and him with all that's necessary from the land in order for him to live physically. If he believed it, he wouldn't go to bed with Hagar and have Ishmael because he couldn't have a seed or a son by his wife. If he believed it, he wouldn't do that. And on the great name thing, I don't really think that Abraham gave that much thought. God did change his name from Abram to Abraham, but the change of name was from exalted father, Abram, to father of multitude, Abraham. And there's no, I'm not aware of off the top of my head, and that's where this particular thing's come from. I'm not aware of Abraham failing in that area, the great name thing. But he certainly did fail in the other two areas. But God had made a commitment, covenant commitments, that were going to stand regardless. And so it became the covenant of life, the promise. And the divine intention was to provide Abraham with a faith-based approach to a real solution to sin. If he would trust God, sin would not be his master. And then there are three more covenants. The second, third, and fourth of the specific covenants that Paul is talking about, Israel being in line with the covenants. The second covenant was actually Deuteronomy 29 and 30, which is specifically stated to be different from the covenant that was made with Israel at Horeb, which is the covenant of the law. So Deuteronomy 29 and 30 come along after the giving of the law, and it's in addition to the giving of the law, a different covenant. And the focus in Deuteronomy 29 and 30 is that God is going to give them the land that he promised Abraham. And it's linked to Abraham. And it's linked to the promise that God made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So the land promise of Deuteronomy 29 and 30 is simply a future or further development of the land promise that he made in Genesis 12. And in the issue of the land covenant that was specifically designed by God to underwrite his provision for his people in their identity as physical creatures who were constantly going to be in need of what land produces. So he's going to give them a land. That way, as physical beings, they would never have lack as long as they walked by faith. He did use the lack of rain and hunger and thirst and those kind of things as disciplinary actions on occasion because they wouldn't walk by faith. But he gave them the land to be their source of physical life. That was to solve the problem of the appetites of the flesh. It was an unconditional commitment by God to Israel with clear indicators of that because in Deuteronomy 29:30 there are clear indicators that Israel would not use the covenant properly. They would take it kind of as a standalone commitment that had to do with only their outer man. And so they would abuse the land commitment from God and actually turn to worship the gods of the land instead of the God who gave them the land. So it was a failure, but in spite of the failure, Deuteronomy 29:30 says, Israel, you're going to go through all this and you're going to turn away and you're going to become apostate, but then God's going to regather you and then you will dwell in the land forever. So the land promise in Deuteronomy is simply the extension of the land promised to Abraham. It's designed to handle the problems of the flesh, the physical issues. And then the third covenant is the second one of these extension covenants. But the third covenant that we are concerned with is found in 2 Samuel 7, and it's called the Davidic covenant. And in the Davidic covenant, it was this covenant was specifically designed by God to underwrite the provision of God for David in his identity as a creature of soul, whose greatest soul need was for some kind of an unconditional guarantee of an ongoing relationship with God because of the severe and automatic disintegration of human relationships under the area of sin in relation to the soul. David watched Saul deteriorate in his soul, in his relationship with God, and he saw God cut Saul loose and cut him off. And so David is struggling with this whole thing about just how much different am I from Saul, and what if God cuts me loose if I do something like Saul did? And so he decides, based on the fact that God's living in a tent, and that just means it's transitory. He's here today and gone tomorrow if he wants to be. And so he decides he's going to build a permanent house, and then God will have a permanent residence, and then maybe God will stick around. And the prophet tells David, hey, man, that's a good idea. Go for it. And then God says, no, no, no. You go back and tell him that I don't want him to build me a house. His son can build me a house, but I want you to know, I want you to tell him that I'm going to build him a house, and his house will be a kingdom, and it will endure forever. And when his son comes along and he abuses the promise of the seed, the security thing in the relationship, when he abuses it, I'll discipline him, but I won't take the kingdom away. In other words, I'm not going to treat you like I did Saul. And God's intention with this covenant was to address the indicators that are clear from the soul's need for a sense of security in a relational environment that's disastrous because of men's sinful propensities, their mistreatment of one another. You've got to have something to anchor your soul in that will enable you to survive the relational tragedies of your physical and emotional life among sinners. So God gave him that commitment. And he basically just underwrote it, said, this is what it's going to be, and it's going to be forever, and come hell or high water, this is the way it's going to be. And it wasn't, what, six chapters later in 2 Samuel that he pulled this Bathsheba thing? And if God was ever going to cut him loose, that would have been the opportunity, the opportune time. But God didn't cut him loose. He forgave his sin and reestablished the relationship and continued. Because the commitment was a firm commitment. It was designed to keep him from acting like that, but even if he did act like that, God wasn't going to rescind it. So we got the body taken care of with a commitment of a permanent land, and then we got the soul taken care of with a permanent relationship with the God of the universe. So whether your human relationships work or not, that one will. And then thirdly, he comes along with what's called the New Covenant. And that's recorded, first of all, in Jeremiah 31:31, but it's also then addressed in Ezekiel 11, Ezekiel 18:31, and Ezekiel 36:26. In every case, the New Covenant addresses the one issue that the Land Covenant didn't address. In Deuteronomy, Moses pointedly said, God's going to give you the land, but you haven't got a heart to pursue him. He hasn't given you a heart to pursue him. So this land covenant is going to prove to be a snag for you because you get an inheritance, but you don't have the heart to handle it under God. And then he gave David the promise of the Davidic guarantee of an abiding relationship that cannot be broken. And David turns around and abuses it by taking another man's wife and then having that man killed. But God doesn't rescind that. It's just an indicator that the issues are not solid yet. So in Jeremiah 31:31, God comes to the bottom line. He says, okay, I'm going to make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. I'm going to take away the stony heart, and I'm going to give them a new heart, and I'm going to write my law on their heart, and they will be my people, and I will be their God, and there won't be any more of this relational disastrous stuff. There won't be any lust of the flesh going on. There won't be any lust of the eyes going on. And the great name thing will be resolved because I'm making them new with a new core value system called a new heart. The covenant was specifically designed by God to underwrite His provision for Israel and Judah's identities, great name thing, the spirit thing, where the greatest spirit need is this need of a great name. And that is really at the root of most of the disaster that happens with the land and the seed. It's this great name thing. In fact, David's reputation in Israel was part of his problem when he stayed home and got in trouble with Bathsheba. Without the new heart, none of this other stuff works. The new covenant itself alone actually promises a fix for sin at the heart level. That will permanently destroy all the propensities of men to exalt themselves in order to obtain a high reputation as a man of spirit. It's going to solve the problem of sin. And that's why we're longing for the redemption of the body. Because that's the last step before all of these covenants kick in terms of all of the details. And then we are perfected in holiness and we don't sin anymore. And the kingdom is here. So these four covenants that Israel was particularly related to was the Abrahamic, which was the umbrella, and then the land, seed, and the great name, which were the land covenant, the Davidic covenant, and the new covenant. Those were the explications of the Abrahamic one. And before we run out of time, I want to address this issue of how does the New Testament address these things in relation to us. Because I said earlier on, one of the greatest problems in theology for evangelicals is this nonsense that the church has become a spiritual Israel and therefore all the promises are going to be fulfilled for the church and therefore you shouldn't look for any fulfillment in Israel or that kind of thing. And that's just not true. The issues of the New Testament as it addresses these three covenants or this Abrahamic covenant addresses them in two ways. First, it never transfers the individual covenants to the church. The church was never promised a land in this world. It was promised a heavenly city, but not a land in this world. So we have to function without commitment of a land from God. The church is not promised a seed, because by the time the church came into existence, the seed had already come. There wasn't any need to promise that Abraham's seed was an eventual thing for the church, because Abraham's seed came in the person of Jesus and he was here on this planet before the church ever got started, so the church never got the seed promise. The issue of the great name was also one of those things that is a done deal. You don't have to be promised a great name when you have one. And for the church, the issue of our great name is 1 John chapter 3, verse 1. Behold, what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us that we should be called the children of God. The issue of God's love for us makes our status incredibly great with no greater possibility. If the God of creation, the High King of heaven, loves us, we are of a status that nobody can improve on. It's the greatest status in the entire creation to be a child of God because of His love for us. That's what 1 John 3:1 says. Consider the manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us by calling us the children of God. So in a very real sense, the church was never given a great name status, because by the time the church came into existence, the gospel was making everybody who put their faith in Christ a child of God. It's automatic. You don't look forward for something that's automatically happened already to you. So in a sense, the land, seed, and the great name, the only thing that was really missing, God didn't promise the church a land, but He had already given them the seed and the great name through the gospel. So we didn't need those two things. What we did need, though, were some other commitments. In the place of the land, what has the church been given? Well, we don't have a land. We're not guaranteed that we're always going to have a piece of ground that will provide all of our physical needs. So what does God say? He says, through Jesus, don't worry about it. Your Father knows you need those things. Just go about your pursuit of the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and God will just add that to you. Don't worry about it. You don't need a land. You got me. And in terms of the seed is the big deal, but He's already come, and He's become our Redeemer, and we've believed in Him. So we already have the fulfillment of that. And the seed said this to us in terms of security. He said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Lo, I am with you till the end of the age. And the author of Hebrews in chapter 13, I believe, says, because the Lord has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you, what have I got to fear? And that's the soul's big issue, is fear. So there are applications in terms of the need. Genesis 3 is a universal need, runs across all the nations, and Israel is not an exemption, and the church isn't exempt from it. But the promises made to Israel were land, seed, and a great name, and they're going to be fulfilled. But when it comes to the church, we've got the same needs, but we've got a different type of approach to it. We're not promised a land, but we are promised a Father who will take care of our physical needs as we pursue His kingdom and His righteousness. So we don't need a land. All we need is His promise, His commitment. On the other hand, we don't need God telling us that He's going to establish us a kingdom for us forever like He did David without any worrying about what's going to happen if I act like Saul. He just point blankly through His own seed's word says, I won't leave you. I won't forsake you. Believe it. You're as secure as you can get. And then, in the terms of the great name, He never promised to make us a great name, but He gave us a great name. He said, you're my children. And therefore, you can't get any greater status than that. You're as loved as you can be, and there is no greater status than being loved by the God who made you. So, physically, emotionally, and spiritually, the church has its needs met, but not through the covenants of the land, seed, and the great name, except as outworkings in history of how it works. So, the first thing that the New Testament says, in effect, is it never transfers the individual covenants to the church. So the church is not Israel, and Israel's not the church. But secondly, it does accept the need that exists behind the covenants, because Genesis 3 is the need, and that's universal. So, under the theme of this is the promise that He promised us, eternal life. Under that thesis, He provides for us by His own commitment that the Father will take care of us physically, the Son will take care of us relationally, and because we are loved by God, we can't get any greater name or status than that. So that's how I see Paul's argument here, that Israel had this given to them in covenant form, and if they'd have just trusted Him, they'd have had it. But their activity in the land proved they didn't trust Him, and so He sent them out of the land. And it happened over and over, where the land was dominated by others. And then finally, God sent both Judah and Israel out of the land for a temporary period of time. And then finally, in AD 65, He kicked them out of the land for 2,000 years. But they're back in it. So, it's all working. But the point that I wanted to make this evening is that Paul was upset about his kinsmen, his brethren, according to the flesh, the Israelites, because they had this thing laid out for them, and all it took was the willingness to trust God and it would work. And they wouldn't.